He dove and turned gently to the right, getting clear of the gap behind them, for that is where the shockwave would come through first and with the most energy. 4 seconds, Irene called out, and polarized all the portholes to avoid people being blinded. 2, 1. Chapter 20. Perkins watched their sole surviving Verdcris walk away to be alone, stopping just under the edge of the stealth netting that covered their small camp. Sergeant Jaetz had been stoic about the death of Tutula, saying he would mourn her properly at the appropriate time in the appropriate manner. Several times Perkins had seen the hulking lizard sitting away from the camp by himself, staring off into the sun, or staring at nothing. Sometimes he pretended to be exercising or practicing a form of martial arts particular to the Kristang. Even he could not mask how distracted he was. Perkins felt sympathy for the Sergeant, knowing it was odd for her to empathize with a member of a species who might have exterminated human life on Earth. Jaetz, she had to remind herself, was not her enemy. They fought the same enemy, and where Jaetz sought to transform Kristang society, while Perkins would be happy to have the whole lot of them drop dead, they fought together. Surprisingly, Emily Perkins found herself trusting Sergeant Jaetz, certainly trusting him more than she trusted most of the Ruhar cadets other than Nert. Ernt Dahl came out of the dropship carrying a tablet, with his antennas drooping.
"I have not yet completed a review of the data files."
The Giraptha turned toward her and fortunately did not attempt to smile, for that expression still looked creepy to Perkins, despite knowing its intention.
"When do you?"
"However, I believe I have enough information to present a preliminary conclusion."
He paused to judge the human's reaction to the translated words. Perkins nodded in exaggerated fashion so there would not be any interspecies miscommunication.
"I was an intelligence analyst. I know the risks of trusting preliminary data."
"Good. Then you will understand my conclusions may change. Colonel, so far the data I have reviewed contains detailed notes of the testing conducted on human and Ruhar subjects. Unfortunately, all the Ruhar subjects died as a result of the testing, for the pathogen is even more lethally effective in Ruhar than in your own people. Do not think me harsh when I say that is not surprising. The pathogen's target is Ruhar, while humans are primarily carriers. The Ruhar were brought here as prisoners of war. Their prisoner status did not allow the Kristang to use them as research subjects to develop a weapon against their own people."
"Oh, hell.
Colonel, if it is any consolation to the families and friends of the dead, I have a list of their names, human and Ruhar. Their loved ones will at least know what happened to them. Also, records are clear these Ruhar did not cooperate in the testing. They did not know they were part of a test until it was too late. Once it became clear they had become infected with an experimental bioweapon, 3 of the Ruhar killed themselves to deny valid test results to the enemy,"
Ernt noted with a tone of admiration.
"Truly, they were brave warriors. I would have been pleased to serve by their side."
"What of the remaining Ruhar? How many of them were in the test?"
"There were 23 in the test, which was conducted in 3 phases, with the 3 groups isolated and unaware of each other. After 3 of 8 Ruhar in the first group killed themselves, and 3 others attempted suicide, the Kristang took steps to ensure future test subjects could not end their own lives prematurely. Colonel, I am sorry to inform you of the deaths of other sentient beings in this cruel test, but that is not the worst information I have to tell you. It appears that the Kristang who remained behind here were not entirely trusted by their leaders. The data we recovered has, as I said, extensive reports of the test results. The data does not include a chemical analysis of the pathogen components, nor instructions on how to synthesize any part of the bioweapon. We also did not recover samples, or the pathogen, or precursor elements. We know what the pathogen does and how it works. We do not have enough information to identify it in either humans or Ruhar.
Shit! Damn it!
The whole damned raid was for nothing? Not nothing. For this data could prove to be useful to Ruhar bioweapons specialists. It does contain details of how the disease progresses in both human and Ruhar, and how the pathogen is spread. The bad news is the infectious components are airborne, can be spread by skin contact or through water, and can remain infectious for 8 days on porous surfaces. The best way for Ruhar to protect themselves is by enforcing a strict quarantine of the human population on Perdassus. He used the Kristang name for that world. Excuse me, I mean to say, Paradise, he added with an unintentionally creepy smile that quickly faded.
Colonel, you likely do not wish to hear this, but...
Yeah, I know. If the Ruhar on Paradise are threatened, the most certain way to assure humans are not carriers of a lethal bioweapon is to assure there are no humans on Paradise, believe me. I had that thought as soon as I heard about this nasty little plan. The Ruhar government is for goddamn sure going to consider humans expendable.
Colonel Perkins, there is another benefit from the raid. We rescued many of your people.
He gestured toward where a dozen of the former control subjects were gathered under the stealth netting. Perkins snorted.
Screw them. I'd trade the whole traitorous bunch of them for Tutula.
Oh, you misunderstand me, Colonel. The benefit I see is if those people are infected with the live pathogen. The data indicated their role in the testing was as a control group. However, the testing was planned to conclude by infecting them also, to see whether their value as a control group was truly valid.
They might be infected? Perkins asked with alarm.
During the raid, her team had stayed buttoned up in their powered armor, sealed against outside air. But after the damaged dropship landed, they had gotten out of their suits the next day. Dahl had found data tagging the group as a test control, and Perkins realized it was impractical to keep the Mavericks sealed inside suits forever. They could not even fly away from the Keepers, and the interior of the dropship was surely contaminated.
Ah, damn it.
The best outcome is if those Keepers and us may be infected with a deadly bioweapon.
The data does not state whether the final phase of the testing had begun, and I think it likely the Kristang guards who remained behind would not have been informed of the testing progress. All the scientists who developed the pathogen and conducted the testing have been evacuated from this world. When we attacked the base, the only personnel there were security guards who were expendable.
Oh, hell. Perkins felt a shiver despite the sun-baked heat of the day.
Then we may be infected also. We are never getting off this rock.
One thing I don't get. Shauna waved a hand for attention. Why would the Kristang risk doing this? Biological warfare is against the rules, she made air quotes with her fingers. Isn't it? They risk the Rindaloo or even the Maxolt punishing them.
Perkins shrugged.
Good point, Jarrett. But I'm sure the Kristang figured they wouldn't get caught. They didn't count on us landing here and uncovering this op. By the time the Ruhar figured out what was going on, half the population of Paradise would be dead and the infection could have spread through their ships to other planets. Without the data we captured, it would be tough for the hamsters to prove the disease is not a naturally occurring mutation of common human viruses. The whole issue of the senior species enforcing the rules is kind of flexible anyway. Perkins tilted her head. Remember, the reason UNEF got sent to Paradise is because our hamster friends contaminated the place with a virus that is destructive to the Kristang. The lizards couldn't put boots on the ground there until they developed a vaccine or whatever, so they sent UNEF down to handle the job of kicking the Ruhar off the surface. The hamsters denied getting involved. They lied their asses off, saying the virus was there in the soil from back when the lizards controlled the planet, and it had mutated over the years. Neither of the senior species did a damn thing about it, and we know the Kristang filed a formal protest against the Ruhar. My suspicion is the Rindaloo and Maxulks only punish large-scale or sloppy violations of the rules. Otherwise, they let the guys on the field play the game? Dave used a sports metaphor.
Yeah, like in football toward the end of a big game that's close, the refs ease up on anything but flagrant fouls, Perkins explained.
Except the damn Zebras always call against the Packers, Dave fumed. Being from Milwaukee, he was, of course, a Green Bay fan.
Yeah, Ski, Jesse winked. Only Packers fans complain about the referees.
Colonel, you think the lizards will get away with this?
Unless it gets out of control and spreads widely through Ruhar worlds. But I don't think that will happen. The incubation period was carefully designed. Those lizards were smart.
This was... Perkins twirled a strand of her hair around a finger, an action that made Dave stare at her in fascination.
I have to admit, a brilliantly designed operation. The lizards could kill every human on Paradise, and most hamsters. They get revenge on us, and they weaken the hamsters' hold on the planet. The Ruhar might even abandon the place. For sure they wouldn't keep a battle group stationed here. The crews couldn't go down to the surface.
You think the pathogen would kill all humans on Paradise?
Shauna's eyes grew wide with fear.
The Ruhar must have technology to create a cure.
I don't think they do have the level of technology to cook up a cure. Not quickly. The data, Perkins tapped her laptop, reveals the tech to engineer this virus is beyond the ability of the Kristang. They must have gotten help from the Theranin or Bosphorak, or they bought it from someone. The Ruhar would launch a full-scale effort to protect their own population. But humans? She shook her head sadly. I can't see the Ruhar diverting resources to help humans, and they don't understand our biochemistry that well anyway. Remember, the way this virus works, the Ruhar would initially think the disease is a natural mutation of viruses that humans commonly harbor. The hamsters will think it's our fault. They won't be eager to help us. I hate to say it. She spoke aloud what she was thinking privately. But with a large part of their population dead or dying, the Ruhar might consider eliminating the source of the infection. Probably they'd start by quarantining all humans. When Ruhar keep dying, she shrugged, the gloves would come off. I could see the commander in orbit hitting human sites from orbit, whether the civilian government of Gitanu approves or not. By that time, the infection would have spread to ships in orbit, unless the battle group got really lucky and all their ships were out of the system during the entire incubation period. This is a nightmare, if the ship with infected keepers gets to Paradise. Those damned lizards would get away with it. Jesse balled up his fists. The senior species really only punish stupidity, Colonel?
That's the idea, yeah, Perkins agreed.
Unless a species is stupid enough to violate the rules in a big way, or unless they commit a minor violation but are clumsy and obvious enough to get caught, they will probably get away with it. It's not practical for the senior species to run around punishing every minor technical violation. This war has been going on long enough for everyone to know how far they can push the boundaries. Coulter, the Kristang will get away with this. Those infected keepers might have already landed on Paradise.
What about us, ma'am? Shauna asked, afraid she knew the answer to her own question.
Us? We remained buttoned up during the raid, but now we've been exposed to the keepers, who might be infected. The hamsters won't take the risk of lifting us off this planet until months have gone by, and we have either died or shown no signs of infection. Even then, she bit her lip. I wouldn't take the risk if I were them. No ship captain will be eager to bring us off the surface here until there is a cure or vaccine available. Probably not until both are available. Thinking about it, if those keepers do not ever reach Paradise, then the Ruhar won't have incentive to make a big push to rescue us. A handful of humans and a couple dozen cadets on this planet are not worth diverting major resources from the war effort. Shit. She realized the endgame of her logic. The only way the Ruhar would develop a cure is if the infection does hit Paradise, and they have to deal with it.
Well, that's it, then? Shauna said with despair.
We're stuck here?
Forever?
Hell, Jesse groaned. I was just getting used to the idea of being stuck on Paradise, and that place is a lot nicer than this hellhole.
I don't think we'll be here forever.
Dave looked Perkins in the eye, and she nodded.
This is a Kristang planet. They'll be coming back sooner or later.
Ah, shit. Jesse's shoulders slumped.
That ain't the worst of it, Dave explained. If a hamster ship does arrive, the best move for them would be to hit us right here from orbit, eliminate us as a threat just in case we're infected.
You are a gosh darned ray of sunshine, Ski, Jesse complained.
It's what we would do, right? Dave retorted in his own defense.
It's what I would do.
The Colonel is right. No way are the hamsters spending the time and money to develop a cure just for us.
Oh, hell. Jesse patted Dave's shoulder. You're right. I shouldn't shoot the messenger.
So, man, what's our next move?
Perkins took a moment to carefully consider that question. They had enough human food aboard the dropship to sustain them for 3 months, four if they went on restricted rations. Cutting their nutrition was a risk, as it might make them more susceptible to infection. The smart move would be to eat normally until the 3-month incubation period passed, then cut back if none of them became sick. If they were sick, it didn't matter how much they ate, because they'd be dead long before they could burn through the supplies. We set up camp here, wait a couple months, and hope the Ruhar are pretty damned convinced we are not carrying the virus. Ma'am, Dave sighed. 3 months is a long time. What are the odds no Kristang ship will swing by this place during that time? His question didn't require an answer. We can't get off this rock until a Ruhar ship picks us up. That assumes any Ruhar ship arrives, Shauna pointed out their biggest problem. We don't know that anyone will hear our beacons. Hey. Jesse didn't like the pained look on Shauna's face and draped an arm over her shoulders. We gotta have faith. We survived this far. What are the odds of that, huh? Somebody up there, he pointed to the sky, has been looking out for us. Jesse had no idea that the being looking out for them was a shiny beer can. Colonel? Shauna approached the folding table where Perkins was sitting under the edge of the stealth netting. The team's daily walks or runs had left clearly visible tracks in the dusty soil all around their campsite, so stretching stealth netting over the dropship and campsite was more for morale than any real attempt at concealment. Dragging homemade mats behind them as they walked, a measure intended to literally cover their tracks, had proven largely ineffective, as the top layer of sun-blasted soil was a different color, and no amount of sweeping could entirely blend in their footsteps. Still, Perkins insisted everyone remain under the stealth netting when in camp, mostly because she didn't trust the keepers not to do something stupid. Their single dropship had been tossed around by the massive blast and came perilously close to splattering on the far slope of the ridge, but pilot skill and a good measure of luck worked in their favor. In the roiling air, the dropship had turned and flown first north, then west, so the prevailing winds carried the short-lived radioactive fallout away, then landed when its one engine turbine began overheating. The spot was as good as any, so they had set up camp around the grounded dodo. They had to wait, for 3 months at least, until they could be certain none of them had brought a deadly pathogen away from the base with them. Ruhar cadets had flown a dropship high overhead to drop supplies, but otherwise the raid survivors and former prisoners were alone. Jarrett, Perkins looked up from her tablet. You have news for me? That day had been Shauna's turn to check everyone for signs of infection with the handheld medical scanner. No, ma'am, not exactly. Everyone checks out. No infection. It was understood that no infection meant no infection the scanner could detect, yet. If the genetically engineered pathogen was as fiendishly ingenious as the Kristang database boasted of, they might be all infected, with the deadly prions biding their time inside clusters of cells. If so, there was nothing Shauna or anyone on the planet could do about it. Can we talk? She asked with a glance around to assure no one could overhear them. With the evening chill fast approaching as the sun set, most people were inside tents or the dropship. Certainly, Jarrett. Perkins set down her tablet as a sign the soldier had her full attention. After the initial excitement of the raid and then analyzing the data, boredom and depression had set in. People had nothing to do except wait to learn if they would die of infection or of starvation, or die in a maser blast from a Kristang warship, or bombarded from orbit by a Ruhar ship. The sense of hopelessness was almost worse for the keepers, because when they saw humans coming to pull them out of their life of slavery at the base, they expected to be rescued. Knowing their would-be rescuers had no way of getting off the planet had been a crushing blow both to keeper morale and to Perkins's thin authority over them. That is why the Mavericks always carried weapons, and why the keepers were not allowed near the precious but crippled dropship. What is it? She asked in her best motherly voice, a tone she had used so often recently that she was getting tired of it. She had signed up for the Army to be an intelligence specialist, not a camp counselor. Especially irritating were the keepers who wanted to justify their stupidity, feeling a need to explain to her or anyone who would listen why they had gotten themselves into such a mess. But the absolute worst were the handful of keepers who refused to believe the Kristang had used them for harmful medical experiments and a plan to use the human population of Paradise as unwitting weapons against the Ruhar. Perkins had cut off their line of bullshit immediately, and kept those true fanatics separate from the other former prisoners. Shauna sat on the rock next to Perkins, crossing her legs in a sort of yoga position, looking toward the setting sun. She took a deep breath, wrinkling her nose at the acrid, burnt smell that pervaded the entire planet's surface. Did the oceans also smell bad? She asked herself.
At times like this, Camp Alpha doesn't seem half bad. But most of the times, I hate this place. The first time we were here, I was too busy and too stupid and naive to pay attention to what a pit this place is. That maybe should have been my first clue that Kristang were not the good guys. It's not that bad, Jarrett. You ever been to the NTC at Fort Irwin?
She meant the National Training Center in the Mojave Desert. When Shauna shook her head, Perkins continued. 110 degrees in the afternoon. And don't believe that bullshit about it being a dry heat. 110 is goddamn hot.
My first overseas assignment was Iraq.
She shook her head in disbelief that America still had boots on the ground in that country, even if those troops were technically only supposed to provide advice and training. Now that place is scorching hot in summer, and the northern mountains get bone-chilling cold in winter. You know what the Nigerian jungle is like? A steam bath on a good day. Camp Alpha is a pleasant spa by comparison. Also, here I don't have to check my boots for scorpions and snakes every morning. Shauna tilted her head back to gaze at the sky. The sun was low enough that the second planet in the system could be seen as a bright star in the sky.
And here all we have to worry about is a Kristang ship jumping in and blasting us from orbit.
Is that what you wanted to talk about? Perkins nudged her tablet as a hint she wanted to get back to work.
No. I'm kind of busy.
No, you're not. Shauna looked her CO straight in the eye.
None of us are busy. We're waiting, and nothing we do down here matters. A friendly ship jumps in to rescue us before the lizards get here, or it doesn't. If we're infected, we die down here, because no ship will take us aboard. There's nothing any of us has to do down here. Nothing that matters.
Perkins noted Shauna had not addressed her as Colonel or Ma'am, and she let it slide.
You're feeling helpless. Is that it?
If that were true, she would be surprised. Sergeant Jarrett had been a squared-away, focused soldier since the day they met. Shauna spat on the dusty ground. The acrid air irritated her throat.
I've been feeling helpless since Columbus Day when aliens pounded our homeworld from orbit. What I'm here to talk about is Dave.
Sergeant Chaika? That soldier had seemed distracted the past several days. Perkins attributed that to boredom after the excitement of combat.
He's planning to leave the force, if we get back to Paradise.
That... the Mavericks without Dave Chaika? She could not imagine her team without... Emily felt a lump in her throat. She could not imagine herself without him. Bunking with that male soldier had been awkward, but just listening to him breathing in the bunk right above her head had been comforting. She missed greeting him in the mornings, even though that was often the most awkward part of the day for each of them.
I know many people are worried about opportunities passing them by on Paradise. But out here we've seen plenty of action. Dave got an offer to go into business brewing beer or something like that. But that's not the problem.
You need to stop stringing him along.
What?
Soldier, that... Shauna let out a long, weary breath.
Don't give me that soldier shit, I'm off duty. This is two women talking. You think out here military protocol matters?
She rolled her eyes angrily.
UNEF is over. It's dead. Whatever authority the Force had so far from home, it died when our access to Earth got cut off.
Jarrett. Perkins refused to use the other woman's first name. Military protocol and the code of conduct are all we have out here. We can't...
No. The code of conduct was all we had, back when we shipped out. If the only thing keeping us together are regulations from a planet that could be dead, then all we're doing out here is playing soldier, and that's pathetic.
These... She tapped her UNEF and U.S. Army patches.
I'm not why I came off Paradise. I want to make a difference. And this team, your team, is my best chance to matter to the future of humanity. When we met, all I knew was you rode a chair as a staff officer, and intel types are not the most popular with foot soldiers. You had to earn our respect, and you've got it. By the time we get back to Paradise, if there is anyone still alive there, the entire force might have dissolved. And where does that leave us?
You told us we need to think long-term about how humans fit into Ruhar society. You're right about that. But whatever strategy we use long-term, UNEF won't be a useful part of it.
You've given me a lot to think about, Perkins replied in a neutral tone.
The strategy stuff can wait. Dave can't.
Think about that first, or you're gonna lose him.
We'll all lose him.
If you are really not interested, then you need to tell him. If you are interested, don't hide behind regs written on a planet 1,000 light years from here.
Dave is a good guy,
Shauna emphasized by squeezing the other woman's shoulder.
That's not easy to find. Again, I need time to think,
Perkins relied, irritation creeping into her voice. Shauna stood up and stretched her legs. The sun had set, and already the night air was growing chilly.
Think about this, then. We're making up the rules as we go out here. Maybe it's time to throw out some of the rule books we took with us from Earth, if following those rules means we don't have a force left. Colonel, we didn't follow you to the stars because of a rule book.
Emily Perkins never picked up her tablet that night, whatever trivial task she had been working on forgotten. She had a lot to think about, and no star to guide her. Jarrett was right. They were fighting a new war with a new human society. Maybe they needed a new set of rules. Still, she had joined the military as a career, and the rules and traditions of the service were deeply ingrained, deeply personal. Rules were the difference between a well-disciplined force and a mob. She had a lot to think about.
Chapter 21. The star carrier Deal Me In was officially declared overdue when that ship failed to contact a relay station as scheduled. The relay station noted the event and sent the notice to a passing ship the next day, but the local Jarraptha Fleet Base commander did not become concerned immediately. She did not become concerned because a delay of 1 or 2 days during a long training mission was not unusual, and because she had much more important matters on her mind. The Bas Farak, who had been quiet for decades along the border they shared with the Jarraptha, had suddenly demonstrated a radical change of tactics. The bird brains had unexpectedly launched attacks into territory recently lost by the Theranin. These attacks, supported by ships of their client species the Wargalin to handle the grunt work of taking planets and scouring solar systems of threats, were mostly conducted by battle groups of the standard Bas Farak fleet action deployment. 2 battleships escorted by a half-dozen cruisers and up to 15 destroyers, frigates, and support vessels. The Jarraptha had long-standing tactics to deal with a Bas Farak battlegroup, either alone or in multiple units, so at first the local fleet commander was not overly concerned. Then she received reports of something new and alarming. Bas Farak and Theranin ships operating together. Based on very skimpy data coming in from Jarraptha ships that had been hit hard by the unexpected enemy offensive, it appeared the Theranin were taking a supporting role in recapturing the territory they had recently lost. Few Kristang ships were participating, perhaps because those lizards were busily enjoying one of their regularly scheduled murderous civil wars. Regardless, it was mostly the Wargalin doing the dirty grunt work of securing planets after the combined Bas Farak Theranin warships cleared a star system of resistance and rolled on to the next objective. So when another 4 days went by, and the Deal Me In still had not contacted a relay station or friendly ship, the star carrier and its attached task force of Ruhar ships was declared missing. It worried the local fleet commander that the Deal Me In had been operating close to the area where the Bas Farak suddenly attacked, and that no other Jarraptha fleet assets had been in that area at the time. The star carrier had been operating there with a group of Ruhar ships conducting training exercises, because that area was supposed to be safe. The local fleet commander had 3 emotional reactions. First, shock and outrage, not at the carnage caused by the Bas Farak attack, but because she recently had wagered the Theranin would not go on the offensive in her sector for another 15 months. Her shock was that she had been caught on the wrong side of the wager, and her outrage was that the unscrupulous bean counters at the central office of wagering
would not cut her a break just because the Bosphorak had taken the lead in the attack. The Renan warships were participating in the offensive, so she had lost the wager, period. That argument would seesaw back and forth in the courts for years, and the terms of the wager might be adjusted slightly, but overall, the local fleet commander was well and truly screwed. Second, she felt sorry for the crew of the Deal Me In and its attached Ruhar task force. Considering the scale of the enemy offensive, the Star Carrier being declared missing very likely meant it had been lost to enemy action, and she quenched her feelings of sorrow long enough to post a wager that the Deal Me In had in fact been destroyed. The third emotion she felt was regret. Regret that she could not spare even a single ship of her overtasked fleet to search for the Deal Me In. That old Star Carrier, with its attached group of older Ruhar ships that had been working up crew trainees for fleet service, was simply not important enough to devote scarce resources to a search she felt certain would have only one result, finding scattered debris. The worst part of the situation was that as the Deal Me In had been operating independently, it did not have a predetermined flight plan when it departed from the planet the Ruhar called Gitanu. It could be anywhere, and even the entire Jarattha fleet might never find a single piece of debris from that ship. No, she could not detach even a frigate for the search operation, so she did the only thing she could do, the only action that might resolve the mystery of the Star Carrier's fate. She used local fleet funds to post an open wager across Jarattha space, a wager that no trace of the lost Star Carrier would be found within 47 days. The terms of the wager were generous and should prove enticing to any commercial vessel crazy and desperate enough to go looking around in what was now Bosphorak-controlled space. Of course, she also registered a small offsetting wager of her own, in the case of a miracle that even one of the Deal Me In's crew were found alive. The Sure Thing was an old, very old, Jarattha Star Carrier that had been retired, sold, and much modified over the centuries, with few of the modifications making the ship better or even keeping it in the marginal condition it had suffered from before the alterations. While the Sure Thing had left its original shipyard with 3 main and 2 auxiliary reactors, 14 hardpoints for docking ships, a railgun and multiple missile launchers and maser cannons, it now was much reduced in power and fortune. A single ancient and leaky reactor powered the ship, with auxiliary power provided by worn-out power cells and a type of primitive Ruhar fuel cells that even the Ruhar no longer used aboard their own ships. Only 3 hardpoints now remained, those being suitable only for cargo containers, which was fine, as the Sure Thing now carried only cargo across the star lanes. Of the original armament, only a single maser cannon remained, other than maser turrets for self-defense. And all those units had exciters that were more likely to explode and damage the ship than protect it. As a search and rescue ship, the Sure Thing had only 3 things in its favor. It was a former star carrier, capable of traveling vast distances on its own. It had excellent sensor gear, because the crew wanted to avoid danger, and even more wanted to avoid Jarattha Revenue and Customs ships that were currently seeking to impound Sure Thing for unpaid docking fees, violating space maneuver regulations, and flying a poorly maintained ship whose spaceworthiness certificate had expired the previous year. And the most important factor in favor of the Sure Thing was that ship's owners were truly, absolutely desperate. They already owed more in unpaid fees and lost wagers than the ship was worth. The crew had not been paid for months, both for salaries and for a lengthy list of wagers the crew had won against the vessel's owners. Thus, the 2 owners of the Sure Thing, a married couple, had nothing to lose when they heard about the wager to find the lost Deal Me In. Unfortunately, they also had nothing to wager with. Vinceriento Vinny Gumbano clicked his antenna together nervously in a gesture he knew his business partner understood was a sign that Vinny was about to say something she might not like. Vinny concentrated on holding his antenna still, but as soon as his concentration slipped, they clicked their tips against each other, causing Amari Viso to cross both her arms and her own antenna.
"What is it now, Vinny?"
"Darling, this is a marvelous opportunity. We'll never get an opportunity like this again."
"You mean never again, because if we don't cash in now, we'll lose the ship and be totally out of action. The next port we put into, the customs and revenue people will seize this bucket, and we can't stop them."
For the past year, the Sure Thing had been running on borrowed time, multiple false registrations, and a well-placed wager that the Customs and Revenue Service would catch the ship within 14 months. The last time they were in port, an official from Customs and Revenue had almost certainly seen through the thin cover of their false registration, but since that official had taken the other side of the wager, that his service would not catch the sure thing, the ship had been allowed to slip away. That particular wager was some of the best money Vinny and Amari had ever spent.
Vinny, dear, you don't need to sell me on this one. I agree. We should take the action for finding the deal me in. There is only one problem. We don't have anything to wager with. We owe more on this ship than it's worth, and the Central Wagering Office knows that. We can't even pay off the bets we've lost in the last year.
We do have something to wager.
Vinny's antenna fairly danced. He was so nervous.
I insured our cargo for double its value.
His eyes cast down to the deck, then flicked upward to see his partner's reaction. She laughed.
You too? I insured it for double.
Vinny was less surprised than he might have been, for he was used to Amari outguessing him.
The cargo is insured for 4 times its value?
5,
came another voice from the hatchway, and in walked their 2 remaining crew members, the only ones who had hung on when the paychecks and wager payoffs stopped flowing. Cletus Delroy had not left the ship because he was Amari's brother, and because he figured his only chance to collect on back pay and wagers was to stay with the ship and watch the 2 owners with keen eyes and a suspicious heart.
We, he pointed to indicate his wife Thelmer, took out our own insurance policy.
You don't have an insurable interest,
Amari groaned, wary of her sometimes dim-witted brother's schemes. Cletus had good concepts. He was just not good at the details, so something usually went wrong. Almost always went wrong.
Don't worry, Thelmer assured the ship's owners. I ran it through shell companies.
You did?
Amari asked hopefully.
Why?
Cletus clacked his antenna irritably.
You don't trust me.
I do trust you, dear brother. I trust Thelmer more.
She did it.
Cletus let his antenna flop.
But it was my idea.
Good. Excellent.
Vinny interrupted, wanting to forestall another argument between Amari and her brother. But he was just a bit too late.
Why did you insure our cargo?
Amari pressed her brother, drawing herself up on her hind set of legs.
Because.
Thelmer stepped between the siblings.
We want to get back pay, regardless of what happens to this ship. At this point, you have an incentive for this ship to suffer an unfortunate accident, if you know what I mean. That might solve the problem you two got into, but it would leave Cletus and me with nothing. Don't tell me that ditching this ship never crossed your mind, Amari. I know you're smarter than that.
Amari looked to her business and life partner, and when Vinny said nothing, she sighed.
Let's put all that aside for now, hm? We have agreed to take this wager, to find the deal me in. You have agreed to the wager,
Thelma insisted.
Cletus and I will keep our interest in the cargo. But honey,
Cletus pleaded,
this is juicy action. You don't want to get in on this one? We are in this.
Thelmer stroked her husband's face with an antenna.
Our part of the wager is the back pay and wagers we are already owed, and will collect if we find the deal me in. Plus our ship owners are cutting us in for 30% for our labor.
30?
Amari screeched, outraged.
5? 5%?
The 2 women argued back and forth, with their men wisely staying out of the way. Cletus went to the galley and got 2 glasses of cold Burgos for himself and Vinny, and they whispered to arrange a bet on what percentage the women would agree to. When Amari and Thelmer grudgingly touched antennas to agree on 12.3%, Cletus smiled and took a sip of the Burgos, having won his wager.
Now we are all agreed.
Vinny's tone was sour, for he wished Amari had negotiated more forcefully. Privately, he would have agreed to cut the crew members in for 17%, so settling for just over 12 was a victory. He enjoyed watching Amari in action, but he hated losing a wager to her brother.
Yes,
Amari's expression was less than happy.
We only have one problem.
What's that?
Cleeters bent an antenna back to scratch the nape of his neck. We have no idea where to look for a single lost star carrier.
I do.
Vinny winked with more than a hint of smugness. You? When our entire fleet has no idea where that ship might have gone?
Our fleet is powerful, victorious, and well-managed. They're also not good at thinking beyond their training. The fleet does not know where the Dielmian went, so they assume they can't know. We are going to figure out where the ship might have gone, check those places one by one, until we find a flight recorder buoy or some other evidence to lead us to that ship.
Where it might have gone. Fleet stated that Star Carrier was on detached service carrying a training group. Their plans were flexible. They could have gone anywhere.
No, not anywhere. Most places they could have gone were safe, and we wouldn't be searching for them now. Wherever they went, they ran into trouble. Unexpected trouble. Something happened. They saw something to pull them out of their training routine. Whatever they saw, it wasn't serious enough to cancel the training exercise and report to a relay station. It had to be something that sparked their curiosity, but wasn't immediately seen as a serious threat.
What? You want us to guess? Amari asked with an anxiety informed by long experience with Vinny's schemes.
No, I want us to review the data we have. The fleet won't send us any more data than they included in the wager, so we need to search elsewhere.
Like, Fleeter scratched his head with an antenna. Where?
We start here.
Vinny grinned, knowing he had hooked his audience.
We know the Dielmian passed by this relay station.
Yes. And? Thelmer was skeptical, having fallen victim to many of Vinny's half-baked schemes over the years. There are 13 star systems within range of that relay station, plus 2 wormholes.
True. But the Glando system,
Vinny tapped the display with one antenna,
was among the first to be hit by the Bosphorak. Before you tell me that information is worthless, yes, we also know from our garrison at Glando that no star carrier arrived until a fleet squadron 4 days ago. We do know the fleet suspects the Bosphorak refueled in this red dwarf system before the attack on Glando. There is an automated sensor picket station orbiting a gas giant around that red dwarf, and one of our recon ships reported that station is now offline.
So?
What if a Ruhar ship attached to the Dielmian jumped into that red dwarf system and noticed the picket station was offline? Investigating a minor mystery like that would be a good training exercise.
Ah. Amari's head bobbed excitedly. Again. So? Fleeters hadn't caught on yet. If we find debris from Ruhar ships, their government would pay us for the information, but that doesn't win the bet for us. We need to find the Dielmian, and a star carrier would have remained outside the system. If Ruhar ships were destroyed there, we should find flight recorder drones in the debris field, Amari explained patiently for her partner. Those drones will tell us where the ship planned to rendezvous with the star carrier. We do have the codes to make those Ruhar drones respond to us, at least for the limited data set we need. The Dielmian should have moved on from that rendezvous point as soon as the Ruhar ships were aboard, but once the crew realized they were in a potential combat situation, they would have dropped off drones to report their planned course. We will query those drones and follow that course. Now that we are officially on a search and rescue mission for the fleet, we also have the codes for fleet drones.
That is it.
Cleeters was not persuaded.
What if we don't find anything in this red dwarf system? There are 2 more possibilities I can think of.
Vinny glared at his brother-in-law.
We keep going.
Hopping around enemy-controlled space until we find something? Or we are caught by a Bosphorak task force. Cleeters leaned forward on his front legs, ignoring his wife stroking the back of his neck to calm him. That is your plan?
You understand why the fleet offered such generous terms on the wager, don't you? Because it is dangerous.
We'll do it, Thelmer said, before Cleeters could respond. The Sure Thing did not find any debris or evidence of a battle in the Red Dwarf system where the automated picket station had stopped functioning. No flight recorder drones responded to their pings, but they did detect gamma ray bursts from enemy ships. Too many enemy ships. Stretching their luck until it nearly broke,
They hopped around the system waiting for drones to respond, then jumped far away when a Theranan destroyer got too close for comfort. The second possibility on their search list, the one Vinny thought had the least promise, paid off for their risk. Vinny grumbled because Thelmer had placed and won a side bet that the second site would provide the data they needed, but he could not argue with success. The second site was nothing more than an imaginary point in space designated for civilian ships to wait for a star carrier in case of an emergency in the Bardek system, close to the former border of Theranan territory. Bardek itself was barely worth the attention of the enemy, having no habitable planets and being useful only for an asteroid field rich in rare elements. But any attackers wanting to push farther into Jarapha territory needed to secure their flanks by taking Bardek first. The rendezvous site where the sure thing jumped in was actually the second backup location for civilian ships to rendezvous, and because it was so far from Bardek, a ship would need to be in severe distress to go all the way there. Vinny's logic had been to check that site first, because a sudden Bosphorok attack on Bardek would certainly be considered a severe emergency. The Sure Thing's sensors, one of the few shipboard systems in proper working order, picked up a large debris field, mostly broken Ruhar ships, but also the remains of a single Jarapha cargo transport ship. Pinging for a Jarapha drone was fruitless. Either the cargo transport did not have time to eject its flight recorder data, or the drone had been destroyed. While warships carried drones with sophisticated stealth capabilities, civilian ships could rarely afford, and rarely would need, such unnecessary luxuries. Pinging for Ruhar military drones was more useful. They got replies from a half-dozen ships, and the drones all told slightly different versions of the same tragic story. Ruhar ships on a routine training mission away from the Deal Me In had detected mysterious gamma-ray bursts, and when they returned, the Star Carrier was sufficiently curious to halt the training exercise and launch two recon task forces, but not sufficiently alarmed to entirely break off from its mission and contact the Jarapha fleet directly. The Deal Me In had dropped off two groups of Ruhar ships, one group at the rendezvous point where the Sure Thing had jumped in. Those unfortunate Ruhar ships had been ambushed by a force of Wargalan ships supported by a single Bosphorok battlecruiser.
Some Ruhar ships escaped. We have the coordinates where they were scheduled to meet the Star Carrier?
Vinny asked distractedly, his concentration on the sensors, wary of booby traps left behind by the enemy.
We do, Amari confirmed. We should get out of here.
Wait!
Cleeters waved both arms and antenna.
We're going to jump into a rendezvous point where a military Star Carrier may have been destroyed? We should think about this first.
Agreed, brother. I have thought about it.
Amari pressed a button on the console in front of her, and the Sure Thing jumped. There were no enemy ships waiting at the rendezvous point, only a drone dropped off by the Deal Me In before it had jumped to pick up the second group of Ruhar ships. This time, Vinny hesitated while their ship's jump coils recharged.
Darling, we are on the trail of the Deal Me In. That is far more than our fleet accomplished. Maybe we should contact the fleet and let them take the search from here. They'll cut us in for 20%, maybe.
Amari sniffed.
They'll cut us out, you mean? We do all the hard work, and now you want to let the fleet take 80% of our wager?
We know the Deal Me In wasn't destroyed here, so every place we jump following that ship, the more likely it is we run into trouble.
Vinny almost pleaded, having suddenly lost his appetite for risk.
If we get caught in a damping field, we get cut out of 100%.
Dearest,
Amari took a breath to give herself patience, as she often did when dealing with her partner.
20% is not enough to pay off our debts, plus the fines we've racked up. It's all or nothing. If we contact the fleet now, even if we get 20%, we lose this ship and we'll be on the run. Again. Do you want that?
No.
Vinny hated being convinced he was wrong, especially because in this case he had thought contacting the fleet was what Amari wanted.
Thelmer, Cleeters, the only way you're getting what we already owe you is if we follow this through.
Vinny's brother-in-law surprised him.
We want our cut. I know it's risky, but we've come this far, dang it. And now I just have to know what happened to that ship.
Vinny was all for taking risk if there was a potential payoff. But since the jump to follow the deal me in involved risk with not much corresponding reward, he directed the ship to jump in far enough away that his ship had a decent chance to escape if enemy ships were in the area. He was excited, and he knew his three companions were equally eager to see if the lost star carrier was at the rendezvous point. The best case would be for the deal me in to be found intact, merely suffering some engineering failure and unable to jump, with the attached Ruhar ships lacking range to jump all the way to the nearest occupied star system or relay station to call for help. The worst case would be to find a debris field surrounded by enemy ships where the sure thing would be trapped and destroyed. With the rotten luck he had recently, and by recently Vinny meant most of his adult life, he was not betting on a best-case scenario.
"No enemy ships, or ships of any kind," Amari reported soon after the sensors reset from the jump. "Unless they're in stealth," she added without needing to. They all understood the ship's sensors, which exceeded even the capabilities of the gear aboard the ship when it was a frontline star carrier in fleet service, could not quickly detect ships encased in stealth fields. She set the passive sensors to search for the faint ripples sometimes detectable when a stealth ship passed in front of a star and powered up the active sensor field. The gamma rays of their inbound jump had lit up the area like a strobe light. There was no point trying to remain quiet.
"Oh, this is not good. I'm picking up debris. A lot of it.
Pinging for flight recorder drones, ours and Ruhar. I've got a bad feeling about this."
Vinny kept one antenna poised over the emergency jump button while his fingers flew over the controls.
"All systems ready to jump, on your mark."
Cleeters didn't take his eyes away from his own console. Vinny was generally an optimist to the point of taking foolish risks that had gotten him in trouble again and again. If he had a bad feeling, Cleeters did not want to remain in the area any longer than they had to. When the Bosphorok battlecruiser jumped away, after having broken the Jarapha star carrier and destroying all the Ruhar ships except for one unimportant old training cruiser that jumped away, it had left a nasty surprise for any Jarapha ships searching for the lost deal me in. The battlecruiser dropped off 11 ship-killer missiles, keyed to react only to Jarapha or equivalent technology ships. The missiles had been instructed to ignore any Ruhar ships jumping into the battle space, as those ships could not reach a habitable planet from that location and were already as good as dead anyway. After their mothership jumped away, the missiles spread out in a wide pattern to cover the area, then went silent and activated their tightly wrapped stealth fields. The missiles noted when the Ruhar training cruiser jumped back in, and they did not drop stealth or attack or react in any way, even when they observed the old cruiser attaching itself to a docking platform on what used to be the aft end of the star carrier. The tiny brains of the missiles were smart, and each missile silently fretted while watching passively as the enemy worked on what remained of the star carrier. The enemy was clearly doing something to get the star carrier's jump drive functioning again, and each missile agonized about whether the Jarapha ship being restored to even limited flight capability should authorize the missiles to attack. If they could have conferred with each other, they might have decided this unprecedented event allowed them to stretch the bounds of their orders. But the missiles had been programmed for strict communication silence. After the astonishing event of the broken star carrier jumping safely away from the battle space, two of the missiles became deranged by their failure to act, and safeguards built into their artificial brains caused those missiles to fry their electronics and hang cold and dead in space, slowly drifting farther from the battle space. The other nine missiles queried their instructions set to determine what they should have done based on their orders, and the missiles decided their instruction sets did not encompass the possibility of a broken star carrier jumping to safety. So, the missiles felt they were free to rewrite their instructions to carry out their overall mission, and they became absolutely determined not to let any type of enemy ship get away ever again, and to hell with their stupid original orders.
"Getting responses from drones."
Delmer's eyes scanned the flood of incoming data.
"That's odd. There is a second set of drones out there."
"Ours? Or Ruhar?"
Vinny asked distractedly, concentrating on his own set of sensor data. It was clear a Jarapha ship had been hit in that area, Enough of the debris was unmistakably from a Jarraptha warship, and he also detected residual signs of Bas Farak warheads. Missiles had been flying, Jarraptha, Bas Farak, and Ruhar. What he could not yet understand was the debris with Jarraptha signatures did not have enough mass to be from an entire star carrier, not even an old one, like the Deal Me In. Had part of the star carrier been transformed into subatomic particles? Or had the Bas Farak somehow, for some unknown but disturbing reason, taken away part of the old Deal Me In? Vinny did not like the thought of that.
Both, Cleeters responded, surprise in his tone. There is a second, later set of drones from the Deal Me In, and from a Ruhar training cruiser.
You are certain they are from the Deal Me In?
The registration code is unmistakable.
Thelmer let irritation creep into her voice. Did the ship's owner think she didn't know her job?
I verified. Missile warning, red. Jump us out of here.
Vinny would not have hesitated except that he had no choice. His antenna nearly pressed the button for a pre-programmed emergency jump. Only seeing a red light flashing on his console made him stop.
Damping field, he shouted.
The sure thing had jumped in just beyond the rough sphere formed by the 9 remaining active missiles, so only 2 missiles had any chance to hit the ship. Fortunately for the sure thing, even the closest missile was far enough away that it needed to compromise stealth by engaging its propulsion system to get within effective range of its warhead. Unfortunately for the sure thing, the missile that was slightly farther away contained a technology that was possessed only by the Bas Farak, Maxulks, and Rindaloo. It was a short-duration damping field, powered by detonation of the missile's warhead. Compared to similar devices owned by the 2 senior species, the Bas Farak damping generator was crude and effective for only a short sphere around the missile. So crude, the Maxulks had not objected too strongly when their clients recently managed to reverse-engineer the technology.
Damping effect? From where?
Amari screeched, throwing up her hands. She did not see a ship on sensors, and no ship could both maintain stealth and generate a damping field at the same time. No known ship had that capability, a thought which sent an icy chill from the end of her antenna to the toes of her hind legs. Could they be facing a Maxulks warship? And why was there the distinct signature of a missile warhead detonation at the center of the damping field? A section of the display caught her eye.
Jump!
Vinny looked at his partner.
But we're caught in...
I know. Jump! Jump now!
The sure thing jumped. Sort of.
What was that?
Vinny hugged a chair with both sets of legs while gripping the sides of the console with both hands, taking even gulps of air to quell his queasy stomach.
Something new. Something we've never seen. The fleet will be interested in this data.
Amari weakly waved a hand at her own console, blinking to make her eyes focus. It didn't help. The problem wasn't with her eyes. It was with her rattled brain, which was throbbing with the beginning of a painful headache. She sent a command to her internal medical monitor to release pain suppressors into her bloodstream and turned her attention back to the data that was still compiling.
The damping field was projected by a missile.
A missile? How?
Vinny realized that question was not important at the moment. The ship had jumped less than 1 light hour from the battle space, and if they were being pursued by an enemy warship, the sure thing was surely in major trouble. If the attack had been conducted only by missiles, the crew had time to inspect and make repairs to the jump drive before moving away.
Forget it. Good work, darling. How did you know?
I saw the damping field had peaked and was already weakening. The missile must only be able to project a temporary bubble. There was either a regular missile homing in on us, she wasn't able yet to make sense of the sensor data, or another damping field coming after the first one passed us by. We jumped just as the damping field strength dropped below the critical limit.
Below the critical limit for most ships, with the condition of our old drive system.
Vinny didn't finish the thought.
Good enough. We have evidence the Deal Me In was destroyed, so we should head back as soon as we...
Not yet.
Thelmer held up a hand for attention.
The Deal Me In was hit, but not destroyed.
It jumped away?
Vinny asked incredulously. From the debris field he had scanned, the star carrier had been thoroughly ripped apart.
Not exactly.
What do you mean, not exactly?